cases. Case number 09, SC 1080, Garcia versus Medved Chevrolet. Are both parties ready?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
I just want to mention, I'd ask both parties to identify themselves at the time of their argument, and you each have to keep track of your own time. Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Dan Friesen. I'm here on behalf of Trina Garcia and all other consumers similarly situated. I am going to try and reserve 5 minutes at the end of my time. This case involves two classes of people. One group of people that were charged for dealer add-ons that were never actually installed on their cars. That proof comes through defendants' standard procedures, standard documents, standard pricing in thousands of cases. The second group of people involves consumers who purchase cars that had add-ons on them, and the disclosure of those add-ons was defective. It was deceptive. It omitted material facts required by Colorado law. In fact, so bad that the trial court found, as a matter of summary judgment, that they were deceptive practices committed against thousands of consumers in the identical manner. The central issue in this case is whether or not face-to-face negotiations, when one goes in to buy a car, defeat predominance because of individual questions of reliance and causation. I'm going to submit that there are five reasons why that central issue should be answered no. Individual questions do not defeat predominance. To get there, I'd like to first address our legal theory for causation, then move directly to those five reasons, and then finally talk about some of the policies underlying the Colorado Consumer Protection Act and class certification, and why this court should expressly adopt the doctrine of presumed reliance in this case.
Mr. Friesen, are you going to be talking about which doctrine? There's a bunch of doctrines on presumed reliance. Are you talking about rebuttable presumption of reliance, which shifts the burden of proof?
Thank you, Judge, for that question. The courts do talk about presumed reliance in two different ways. One is as an inference, permitting an inference of causation from circumstantial evidence. Another is actually presuming that there is reliance on a fraudulent omission, and therefore shifting the burden to the defendant to show that there was not reliance on that. I submit that in this case, either an inference or as an evidentiary presumption doesn't really matter. Class certification is appropriate either way, because the core question is whether or not there are common issues of proof on causation, and whether you have a common inference from circumstantial evidence, or you have a common presumption. Either way, we establish the predominance requirement for one of the elements. So let me talk about our theory of causation. So I guess we're going to be talking about both, and it doesn't matter. The distinction is important in many cases, but it doesn't matter for class certification here. Let me talk about our method of causation, of proving causation. And I think to understand that, first, a little bit about this predominance requirement. As the court's questions in the previous case indicate, there's considerable deference to the trial court on factual questions about whether or not common questions will predominate. That's why the standard of review is for abuse of discretion. Here, our trial court found predominant questions. Also, it's not critical that there be predominance on every single issue, but just on some of the important issues. In our case, we have predominance on a variety of issues, dozens of issues, and the only question is whether or not individual questions on causation defeat that predominance on a variety of other issues. Now, I submit that not only do they not defeat predominance on the other issues, they actually support the predominance in this case. So the rule that we rely on is really quite modest. It doesn't require this court to take any grand steps. And that rule is simply this, that in fraud cases, and especially fraudulent omission cases, one can infer that the fraudulent omission resulted in some harm from circumstantial evidence. Now, we're not suggesting that every circumstance results in causation or results in an inference of circumstance, results in an inference of causation, but there are some, and Colorado courts have recognized that. This court in 1984, in the Kopinick case, said circumstantial evidence can show causation. This court in 1937, in the Morrison versus Goodspeed case, said that a fraudulent omission shifts the burden to the defendant to come forward and, quote, prove to demonstration that it, the fraudulent omission, was not relied on. So this court has suggested and confirmed that in fraudulent omission cases, circumstantial evidence can be proof of causation. That's been applied in the Elk River case in the Court of Appeals, in the Lurby case in the Court of Appeals, and in the British Petroleum versus Patterson case that this court is hearing this afternoon. So the notion that you can infer causation from circumstances is well settled. It's not controversial. The only question then becomes, why not allow it to be applied in a class action? We are not claiming that we are immune from proving causation in a class action. We understand we have to prove all the elements. The Court of Appeals, in this case, spent a long time talking about fraud on the market. We never argued fraud on the market as a basis for proving causation on a class-wide basis. We always argued that the circumstances for every single class member showed causation. They were sufficiently similar. In fact, they're uniform for every class member for class one and for class two. And that uniformity in the circumstances that give rise to an inference is what allowed us to have predominant questions of causation. So, that doctrine about allowing circumstantial evidence to show causation on a class-wide basis has been applied by the Colorado courts. In Elk River, that was a class action. The Court of Appeals said circumstantial evidence showing causation for the class. In British Petroleum, they reached the same result. Again, court hearing that case this afternoon. There are many jurisdictions out there that have applied the same rule and said that where the circumstances are sufficiently uniform, you can find causation on a class-wide basis. Now, there are some courts that go the other way, and they say that, well, in a misrepresentation case where maybe you got one representation but not another, maybe you heard parts of what they said and not other parts, where there's not sufficient uniformity, okay, there's not sufficient uniform circumstantial evidence to show causation on a class-wide basis, predominant is defeated by individual questions. So really the issue is, are the circumstances sufficiently uniform? And our view is that here, they are uniform, and that there is a causal nexus. Class one is relatively easy. People were charged for items that were not installed on their cars. Now, the proof of that is somewhat elaborate. The circumstances showing how the charges were added, how people got that put in their stack of final documents, and how they ended up paying that. But the question, would it have mattered to somebody if they had been told, by the way, before you sign on the dotted line, I think you should know, what you're being charged includes charges for dealer add-ons, about $500, that weren't actually installed on your car. You still want to buy at that price? It is self-evident from those facts that an inference of causation is possible. So there are a lot of cases out there that reach essentially the same result, where somebody has, there's a product available, identical product for a cheaper price, and if you don't tell the person that, it's self-evident that that would have been important to them. If you think the interest rate is going up on a security, and it's actually, if you tell them you think the interest rate is going up and you actually know it's going down, it's self-evident that that would have resulted in a different choice.
Shreeson, what about the argument that Medved makes that there's no special duty between a buyer and seller of a car, and that there's an independent duty? In other words, it's an arm's length transaction and so forth. What about that? That differentiates it from the traditional affiliated youth kind of case and securities, obviously.
And I think I understand the argument that respondents have made there, saying that the duty to make disclosure and the presumption that can arise from that only exists where there's some kind of special duty to make the disclosure. Well, number one, there is a special duty to consumers to make the disclosures at issue here. Number two, the whole notion that you can infer causation from the circumstances of what they said arises from the materiality of the information that they're withholding. Sometimes that information is material because of your special relationship and somebody's relying on what you say. So, for example, in the Affiliated Ute case, the bankers were fiduciaries to the Indian tribe members. Although the court struggled with that issue as to whether or not they were merely transfer agents or whether they really did have a duty. But regardless, once there was an expectation by the tribe members that it was likely, an expectation that these people are going to deal with me honestly, that they have certain duties to make disclosures. That is, that the information that they give me is not some puffing in a negotiation, but it's actually material information. When it's material information, if you think about the definition of what material information is, it is information on which a reasonable person would likely rely. So by definition, if it's material, as the Affiliated Ute opinion explained, then a reasonable person would likely rely on it. Well, what does that say? That suggests that you can have an inference of causation from a material omission because a reasonable person would rely on it. It's especially appropriate in a class action because we have the collective judgment of an entire class, the quintessential reasonable person, if you will. So whether or not there's a duty really goes to a couple issues. One is we have a duty here to treat consumers fairly. The Colorado legislature has said this information is material, and I submit this court should follow the direction of the Colorado legislature, not make new law. This court should acknowledge that the Colorado legislature says this is material information. And when somebody omits it, that gives rise to an inference that can be applied on a class-wide basis, that the failure to get that information caused them harm. As I said, in the individual case, class one, by the way, we're charging you for something not on your car. So, Justice Bender, in direct response to your question, there is a duty here. The duty really is another way of saying the information they have to disclose is material. And there's also an expectation that the person has. If I'm a beneficiary of a trustee, I expect the person to deal with me honestly. And in Affiliated Ute, they expected their bankers to tell them the truth. They expected their bankers to say, you know, we're actually making some money with other people on this same transaction more than we're paying you. Here, we have a law in Colorado that says consumers can expect that car dealers will deal with them honestly. And because we think this is kind of a risky area, we're going to require them to disclose in writing exactly what they're charging and for what. And that's particularly important in installment sales, because the legislature recognizes that there's a risk that if you don't make them put it in writing and say exactly what they're charging consumers, they'll negotiate on the monthly installment price.
Can you please respond to the opponent's argument that, in fact, the class has been drawn too broadly because you have included not really installment sales or financing, but cash sales as well?
There are two different parts to the Protection Act that we're relying on. Certainly, most of our writing and lip service to the installment sales. But the Consumer Protection Act also has a subpart L that states simply that the seller has to disclose the price, what people are buying, and any reductions in the price. So people who buy installments certainly are subject to the installment sale provision, but there's also another provision that just prohibits deceptive practices in any transaction, and it's a broader section. So I think our response is we meant to cover both groups under two separate parts of the statute.
Also, before you move on, can I just get you to follow up where you started, which was that there are two groups in your classes, and the first class is the one that it was charged for an add-on but did not receive it. And you kind of played out your reliance argument on that group, which is basically nobody would pay for something they didn't get, correct?
Correct.
Can you play it out with your second group?
Yes. Our second group is a group of people who received, you know, a stack of closing documents, and the Colorado legislature said that in that stack, because these are installment sale contracts, but also to a lesser degree all contracts, the dealers are required to put in line items of what people are getting charged and how much they're paying. So we know that that information is material because the Colorado legislature declared that it's material. And I think a good case on that is the Phil Long Ford case, where the odometer was required to be disclosed, and the court said it's material if the Colorado legislature said you had to do it. So back to my response to Justice Bender's question, which is, to the extent that it's material information, by definition of materiality, that gives rise to an inference that a reasonable person would want to know it. That inference is common for the whole group. Here it's particularly compelling, the underlying facts. We have a stack of closing documents. They claim that they disclosed the price of these add-ons in a window sticker that was actually put on the car. They also claim that the final buyer's order gave the amount that they were charging. But as the trial court pointed out in granting summary judgment in favor of the plaintiffs, in favor of Trina Garcia and those similarly situated, is that the prices that they claim are so clear and unambiguous and in writing and fully disclosed aren't the same. That there are inconsistencies between their own documents. They also have line items for all the things that are added to the price of the car. I suspect we've all been frustrated by this. What, you know, why are you charging me for an extended warranty? Why do I need a maintenance plan? Why do I have gap insurance? And those are all line itemed out. But what's not line itemed out is how much they're getting charged for all these dealer add-ons. That is supposedly disclosed by an asterisk, which cross-references a window sticker, which price doesn't match with the price that's on the buyer's order. That's why the court grants summary judgment. So those circumstances, identical in every single case.
But how about the circumstances that some had stickers and some didn't have stickers? I mean, you kind of play it out. I mean, I understand your first class is pretty clean, the way you presented the facts, but how about the second? I mean, aren't there differences in what people saw and what the dealer said? I mean, you alluded to that argument, but can you squarely face it on for me?
Yes, well, that, I think that's, Judge, a good segue to my five reasons.
Okay.
if I don't respond with yes. these five reasons, please ask me again. The five reasons really are as follows. First is, am I too close to the mic? I'm talking too loud, I apologize. The five reasons are really that this is a requirement that a written disclosure be made. Their statement that things happen in face-to-face negotiations are verbal statements. So they can't escape the fact that we have uniform written violations of the CCPA. Those uniform written violations give rise to a uniform inference of causation. So reason number one, nothing verbal cures these written disclosures that we have proof of in every case. Reason number two is they say, well, maybe people talked about price, maybe they negotiated this, maybe they said that, maybe they didn't. It's absolute speculation. In fact, the case was put together looking at a sample group. We asked for more, but all they were willing to do was turn over 2 weeks of stuff following a motion to compel. We look at 83 cases. In those 83 cases, we have the transactions that are the subject of this case. In not one of those cases did they present an affidavit or testimony from a customer or from a salesman, nothing, suggesting that this speculative cure, this verbal cure of the written defects actually happened. So reason number two is it's sheer speculation. Reason number three is it's implausible. It's implausible for both classes. I've already sort of explained why it's implausible for class one, that they corrected the defect by saying, by the way, we're charging you for stuff not on your car. It's implausible for class two when you look at the circumstances because you have all these confusing items. Their proof at trial And I think this is in the record. Their Exhibit A to their opposition to class certification is just that we negotiated. They didn't offer proof that we cured anything. Their proof at trial, proof in the trial court, is also that they didn't talk about price. Scaglione's deposition was that they actually try not to talk about price and what people are being charged for. All that is before the trial court. So what we have, and I guess I should point out one other thing, I almost forgot, and this is one of the more important ones, and that is page 13 of the opposition brief has an actual copy of the buyer's order. And the buyer's order says, this is the buyer's order used in every single one of thousands of cases. It says, this order comprises the complete and exclusive statement of the terms. So they have an integration clause that says that none of those verbal cures that they say exist. Now, it's in small, fine print. You have to put your reading glasses on to see it. But they say it to every consumer that they can't rely on any verbal statements. So reason number three is that one is that this is a written statement. Two is it's speculative that they cured it. Three is the evidence is actually to the contrary that they cured it. And four is suggested by this court's questions this morning, and that is this is a factual question. To the extent that you need to rely on Scaglione's statement or Exhibit A, those are all things that are before the trial court. And what we have is a trial court entering a detailed single-spaced opinion, reviewing the evidence and making findings. And reason number five, and I think this it would have been helpful for this reason to come out more this morning, and that is the distinction between a decision on the merits and a decision on class certification. And the arguments that they offer really go to the merits. And our position goes something like this. It's tricky to decide where a merits inquiry stops and where a class decision begins. The plaintiffs, we have the burden of going forward and showing that there is class-wide proof that applies to everybody. And we do that by showing a common inference for class one, the materiality of the omitted information for class two. The legislature said if they don't get it. And then they can rebut that. They can offer individual evidence that our class-wide proof might not be true. But what they can't rebut is that we have that class-wide proof. If we have that class-wide proof, we have enough to show predominance. We have enough commonality, or maybe the better way to say it is...
Oh, wait a second, Mr. Friesen. That goes a little too far, at least with respect to benzene. I mean, there has got to be some overlap if there is evidence produced. And the hard question, I think, is what is the test?
And
it has to be some.
Absolutely.
Because benzene stands for a proposition that factually the class was defeated and it wasn't an abuse of discretion.
And we have to come forward with evidence. We have the burden of proof to show that we have class-wide proof. They can rebut that and say, no, you don't have class-wide proof. So
your argument basically here is based on the evidence that was produced in front of the trial court, they didn't come forward. They had an omission of evidence, basically. That's your argument, isn't it?
Well, partly, Your Honor, yes. But it's more than that. It's partly that we had substantial evidence that did show predominance on a whole list of issues and predominance on causation, because we have the sort of the facts I've alluded to already, and we have a material omission. So we have predominance on class-wide causation. We have predominance on lots of other issues. We've met our burden. And remember, this is not a burden that we win, that we get paid a lot of money. This is just we get enough to send a notice to the class, giving them the right to opt out if they want to. This is just a case management tool. The trial court looked at all this and said it would be silly to ask the same question to thousands of people. Did it matter to you that they charged you for things that weren't on your car? Yes, it did. Next witness. That wouldn't be a good use of the court's time. And we could prove causation, the causal nexus here on a class-wide basis. Those are the five reasons why face-to-face negotiations don't matter. I want to take a couple minutes before I reserve some.
May I just interrupt you right there before you move on? You've outlined a number of reasons why the face-to-face negotiations wouldn't matter in this particular case. Is it your, you're inviting us to adopt presumption of reliance in general for the reasons you've stated, do face-to-face negotiations ever matter? And if so, I mean, how do we square this situation if we're trying to adopt a common rule with what was going on in Benzing?
Yes, face-to-face negotiations do sometimes matter.
When?
And the rule is when you're relying, when the plaintiff is relying on what was said in individual negotiations.
So in other words, an affirmative misrepresentation as opposed to a material omission?
That would be one of the situations.
Okay.
Yes. Because the materiality of the omission is what gives rise to the inference of causation. But I can imagine a lot of situations in which the circumstances would be very different. You wouldn't have the kind of uniformity we have here. And that there is a necessity for a case-by-case factual analysis. And so what our argument really is that uniformity among the class can be enough. It might not always be, but it can be enough. And you don't have to have direct evidence of reliance in every single case. And the person who answers that question is the trial judge, in this case, Jane Tidball. And she did an excellent job of considering all that evidence and deciding what the appropriate outcome would be to manage her docket. And I have some policy reasons to talk about, but I'm going to reserve the last part of my time.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Sean Connolly with Dan Riley, represent John Medved individually, the Medved dealerships that are sued in this case. Benzing held that a CCPA class action can be certified only where each CCPA element, and there are five of them, is provable with class-wide evidence. The class failed in Benzing because this court concluded that plaintiffs had no class-wide method there of proving injury and causation. That conclusion is even more apparent here. If individual dealings between policyholders and insurance agents are too individualized to support a class, then so too, a fortiori, are individualized negotiations between car buyers and car dealers with respect to pricing of a car. The Fifth Circuit held in the Robinson case, authored by Judge Jerry E. Smith, that individualized negotiations about price of a car are too inherently individualized and depend too much on the face-to-face negotiations and haggling that go on in car pricing to support a class-wide challenge to pricing.
Well, can I stop you there? Can you help or directly respond to the argument that nobody would knowingly pay for something they didn't get?
Yes, back to the individualized negotiations.
How could you, the question is, how do you negotiate? Well, who would negotiate to pay for something they didn't get?
They wouldn't, and it didn't happen, and this is why.
Okay.
There are two components to pricing that are challenged here. One, when you go up to a car window and you see a sticker, it's called the Monroney sticker. Federal law says you have to have an MSRP sticker. It says, let's say, $15,000 MSRP for this Chevy Cobalt that includes bucket seats and all the manufacturer options. That's on a window, $15,000. Right next to that on the window is an addendum sticker, where MedVet and other dealers would add dealer add-ons. All right, there may be an add-on, let's say, a roughly ballpark of $500 for pinstripe and a protective coating on the car. All right, that would be a dealer add-on. And clearly on the window, you have an MSRP, $15,000, and you have a $500 dealer add-on sticker price right next to each other. And then it says total $15,500. That's the starting point. You negotiate from there. And for example, they say 24 people under their statistical evidence, and then we challenged that during a two-week sample period. They say 24 people did not get what they paid for, allegedly. We dispute that. They have no proof they didn't get it. The simple proof is that we can't prove it through our records. So that's the first burden shifting that's going on here. There's no proof they didn't get it. In fact, if you had an individualized case, you'd say, did you get it or not?
Mr. Conlon, before you go off on that, let me just ask you a question. I mean, if you're negotiating against the 15-5, right? But if you don't actually have the 5, then it's a false and an artificial negotiation.
Oh, but Your Honor, you do have the 5. Anyway.
But, I mean, the allegation is that you don't have the 5.
The
and so you're negotiating against something you don't have. You're negotiating against yourself. And then the question of reliance is, why would you do that? Nobody, just Justice Ives said, why would anybody really do that? So the heart of the issue is that $500.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we would submit you do have it. The argument that you don't have it comes on the back end. It's the
back end. What do you mean by that?
The back end of the process. It's on page 13 of our brief. We have a sample buyer order form.
Look at it.
The alleged violation, provable class-wide, and we dispute this a violation, but the alleged violation, if you look on page 13, There's a line there that says cash price, quote, including accessories and optional equipment. And it would say, it usually wouldn't say 15,500, but a lot of cases would be less than that. It might be 14,000, because sometimes you pay less than MSRP. But in any event, the alleged violation is that on that line, there was not, according to Mr. Friesen's word, a line item description of that. Well, nothing in the statute says there has to be a line item.
But there's an assumption. I mean, you work against whatever number they give you, and assuming that that's what they're selling you, and you're working against that number.
Your Honor, this is a critically important point, and let me try to address it very clearly.
Okay.
The buyer order form is generated only after the buyer and the agent have come to an agreement on the price. And that's why I say it's a back-end document. You look at the typical things laid out in Exhibit A to our class certification opposition. Patrick Miedo is the head of sales at MedVed. The way a negotiation happens, you come on a lot, you look at a car, and you look at, and the first thing you'll see if you look at the car are two stickers on the window. You'll see the MSRP, 15 under hypothetical, and 500. And then you'll say, what do you want to pay for it? And you'll buyer might say, I want to pay you 13.
Right, but you say, what do you want to pay for it, assuming that the price is 15.5?
Exactly.
And it's not 15.5 because you're not getting everything that 15.5 would get you. You're getting 15.2, 15.1.
No, you're getting everything. I mean,
if you're not getting what's in that five, you're not getting everything. And so it's an artificial negotiation.
And
try to help me understand that.
Yes. Because it's a starting point. You see a car, and then typically you would see a car with the two stickers on the window. You'd see pinstriping and a clear protective coat, and you'd say, when are you going to pay for that? And then you'd say the asking price. It's not like buying a gallon of milk at Safeway where it's $2.99. You come in, everybody knows this is the asking price, and there's ample evidence in the record. That's the starting point. And the starting point is 15.5 under this hypothetical. And the buyer orders form only comes at the back end when you said we've agreed on the price. We started at 15.5, and most people, and it's in the evidence in the record, 16 of the 24 cases that they say people were charged for but didn't get what they paid for, 16 out of 24 people, the price that they ultimately agreed on was less than the MSRP price.
So, Mr. Connelly, you're assuming that the add-ons were added, and the 30B6 depositions say they weren't, and the judge's findings say they weren't. So for the purpose of class certification here, that seems pretty strong, right?
Well, I don't think the judge could have made findings on that. There was no evidentiary hearing, but in any event, let's assume...
Well, she says, based upon the discovery in several 30B6 depositions of defendants, Garcia alleges that customers were charged for uninstalled dealer added-on products in 33 out of the 83 retail car sales. So why isn't that good enough for class certification here?
Because the only evidence that they were not charged for that is the absence of our records saying that we don't have a purchase order proving a phone.
Wait a second. You say the only evidence, but did you produce evidence that you did put this stuff on?
No.
Okay. And your own witnesses, didn't they testify in depositions that they had to have a purchase order or... I forget, an RO, whatever that stands for. Thank you. I figure you know that. Right? And if there is an absence, then it didn't go on, right? So you had the responsibility, didn't you? I mean, to come forward and say, hey, this is not true?
No, we would submit that a class action shouldn't be used to distort substantive proof. Normally, if an individual somebody would come in and say...
It sounds like they didn't distort it. They produced a sampling. And made legitimate conclusions from sampling, which the judge agreed upon.
Which seemed to be consistent with what the evidence is that you put on about how you could assume that this stuff wasn't added if there wasn't an order to add it.
Right, I don't submit that shipment burden proof, but let me accept that.
Let's go from there and see what happens.
These customer people didn't get it. The question is, how can you infer, and there's zero evidence of this, that they paid for something? Is all the evidence is you paid for something you didn't get? Why would anybody do that? How can you infer that? In my hypothetical, and again, it's a back end in terms of the purchase order, but they see $15,000 MSRP on the window. They see a $500 add on the window, and they end up paying $14,000. And the testimony is that 16 of the 24 people that allegedly didn't get something paid less than the MSRP price. That is, paid.
Mrs. Garcia paid less, paid more.
Right?
So I guess she's just, as you say, an aberration.
I think she's an aberration.
An anomaly.
I think she's clearly an aberration for several reasons, and we laid them on the record, that she came in, dealt with a used car agent who had never sold a new car, according to her testimony, and there was a dealer trade that came in that day. So, yes, things happened in Ms. Garcia that shouldn't have happened. And that's what makes us as a named plaintiff, she should be entitled to get a refund of the add-on price that was charged her. Absolutely. But she is not typical, and for the very reason that 16 of the 24 people that are allegedly similarly situated to her actually paid below MSRP. So in the hypothetical...
But why does it matter whether they paid below MSRP? If what you're saying is the reason there's not a commonality or typicality here is because there's this negotiation, it's a false negotiation. So what does it matter what the bottom line is? It seems to me what matters is the top line, what you're negotiating against.
And if
you're not negotiating against a true purchase price, that is, I am buying these things and I am getting these things for X. Now let's see what I can do, X minus whatever the negotiation is. But the X is the important number, isn't it?
I agree. And I want to take issue, if I can, with the false negotiation. I don't think there's anything false about it. You see a sticker price in the window, and you might say, I don't want these add-on products. And therefore, I don't want to pay for them, and I'm going to pay below MSRP. And how can you show? Our point is, even assuming they can show a uniform theory of violation, and the theory of violation is a formalistic violation on the bioorder form. It's a failure to itemize.
You can say I don't want them, but they're on the car already, so you can't really have them take them off.
No,
so here's this car, and you go in and say, all right, well, I don't want the car with the pinstripes, take them off. Or they say, here's a car with the pinstripes, this is what it's cost, but we'll negotiate it down.
No,
but in any event, you're talking about real pinstripes or not, aren't you?
But the theory of class one is that they're not on the car.
That's the point.
And so the question is, if somebody said, that's my point. If somebody says, I don't want them on the car, and they pay below MSRP, then you can't, under their class, they'd be class victims. And they were asking this court to infer that they were injured and that injury was caused by the lack of disclosure when, in fact, they didn't want these products and, in fact, they didn't pay for them. Now, Ms. Garcia is an outlet. Ms. Garcia, Your Honor, is a bad fact. There's a perfect storm of things that happened and blamed on our brief. If she were typical, it would be a different case.
Mr. Conley, just in terms of this little argument about the effect of the starting price, if you will, of the sticker price, I mean, you seem to be suggesting that if you don't want items that are on the sticker price, then the dealer, just takes them off. In other words, that the difference between the final price and the sticker price reflects the consumer's desires with respect to the add-on pieces. It seems to me that if you look at it as reflecting a discount, you probably arrive at a different conclusion in terms of the importance of the starting price. It also seems to me that if you regard that starting price, as having some validity, and as Justice Rice has been indicating, that you're negotiating against that price, that makes your argument very difficult. I was actually surprised that you take the posture that that price has this big effect on the negotiations and the final price. Certainly some people go in and regard the sticker price as, pie in the sky and try to figure out what the reasonable value is from multiple other sources. However, since you have accepted that notion that the sticker price is the starting point, then I guess I'm failing to understand why someone negotiates. They've negotiated for a discount, but it's not attributable to anything in particular. It's the difference that they've managed to get. You want to attribute it to the add-ons. Maybe they're not paying for the add-ons. Well, they're paying for the entire car with add-ons. The question is just how much of a discount they got from the sticker price.
No, I'll put it on the class action. We're not in the merits. Our point is that the class action depends. You said some people. That's our point. Some people have different individual negotiating styles, and that's exactly what the Fifth Circuit said in Robinson, that the realities of having some people, they said that had to do with adding a vehicle tax, and some people said some people might do bottom line negotiation, some people might do top down negotiation. It varies. Our point is that you can't determine class wide injury and causation without saying, where's the negotiation? And we have evidence in Exhibit A that some people come in and say, they negotiate the two separately. They'll say, well, I want to pay below MSRP, and I want to pay zero for the add-ons. And if that's the case, then that's some people, that type of person has not been injured. And our simple point is that to prove whether anybody was injured, it cannot be done on a class-wide basis without saying, what was the negotiating? What happened in this particular case? And I think, in the two classes, if you have some people saying that they paid for something they didn't receive, why did anybody want to do that? The answer may be they didn't pay for it because they didn't want to receive it. And how can you put somebody in class one and say they paid below MSRP, and there are people in this situation, we've laid them out, hypothetically $14,000 they paid for a car that had $15,000 MSRP and would have had a $500 standard add-on. If they paid $14,000 because they said, we don't want this add-on package, they're not injured. But in a class case, we'd be stuck with the same, that they're victimized by some kind of class, even though in an individual case, they suffered no injury.
Had they known about it, they would have negotiated for 13.5.
But the point is, Your Honor, the assumption that had they known about it, if this were really a uniform omission case, that would be a valid assumption. But the only omission, and I keep saying in the back end, and I really want to make this as clear as I possibly can, the first disclosure of the price of the MSRP and the add-ons is on the very window of the car they're buying. Now, it didn't happen with Ms. Garcia. We laid out it was a dealer trade, and there are reasons why that didn't happen in her case.
Okay, let me make sure I understand this. So this extra sticker that's on the car that says you're getting $500 worth of add-ons, that you say it doesn't really matter whether those add-ons are really there or not.
Oh, it matters. If that sticker's okay on the window, they will see it.
So, and so if the sticker's on the window, then you have those add-ons.
And you might be looking at a car, though, that says, I don't want this. I don't like this pinstripe.
No, but you're just, your car has those add-ons, right?
Yes.
They're there.
Yes.
You can touch that pinstriping.
Okay.
Well, the other side is saying, no, you can't. The pinstriping's not there. No. So whatever the heck we're talking about is not there. These add-on things are not there. So that's what I'm not getting about what you're saying.
Well, let me try to make
it. Try one more time, please.
There are two classes. That's maybe part of the problem. Class one, as Justice Sides pointed out earlier, is people that allegedly paid for something. We've disputed that. And
it's not
that. That's 30% allegedly. And we dispute that. But class two are people that actually got what they paid for but didn't have an adequate disclosure. Let me just interject here very quickly. Ms. Garcia is not a member of Class 2. That's a separate problem with this whole thing. It's a headless class. There's nobody in Class 2. There's one class member here. She's Ms. Garcia, who says, I paid for something I didn't get. So how she can represent people that got what they paid for, that's part of the problem in terms of blurring. But in terms of Class 1, people that allegedly paid for something they didn't get, had they looked at a car in the lot that had an addendum in there, the product would have been on that. They would have looked at that and said, I don't like this product. I don't like the pinstriping. I don't like the protective bra. I want a different car. And then they would look at that, but that would be a sticker they'd have at the start of the negotiations and say, I don't want to pay this $500 for this product. And they'd negotiate their price, individually come to some kind of price. Hypothetically, we've been using the number $14,000. They would have paid $14,000, and they would have negotiated that off the MSRP price and paid nothing for the for the add-ons that they didn't get and didn't want. And the problem that we have with a class action is that you're asking to draw an inference, not just a violation, but Benzie makes clear you have to, you know, have class-wide proof of causing injury to each member of the class. And our point is simply that for this hypothetical buyer that paid $14,000 at below list price of MSRP and didn't get product, how can you infer that they were injured? That's something that's an individualized inquiry. We submit that to show when they caused any injury by the alleged non-disclosure on the back end. We would say not. But we can't prove that on a class-wide basis. We'd have to prove that by having the person in and saying, what did you know? Really, if you had to say one question we'd like to ask, what did you know about add-ons? They're trying to infer from the fact that the buyer order form didn't have a separate line item itemization of this is the breakdown of what you're being charged for the car itself, the MSRP, whatever manufacturer options has, and this is what you're paying for the dealer add-ons. They're trying to ask this court and ask a trial court to infer that therefore they were injured by that. And we submit that the Benson says you can't do that. In fact, the individualization of what happens in buying a car is far more, we would submit, than what happens when you buy and deal with your insurance agent buying UIM insurance. There's no negotiation there. They're saying, here's what it's cost, here's what you're going to pay. It's a very State Farm, Allstate, they're all charging the same thing for the UIM coverage. And we submit that Benzie is a far easier case to class than this case. And then if I could just talk about the case law in general in this area.
Benzie, there was specific evidence about the practices, about the face-to-face practices, and that there was a benefit that was contrary factually to the plaintiff's theory. and benzene, at least that was clear on the trial court level. Yes. Secondly, in the Court of Appeals opinion, relied entirely on fraud in the market theory, which has no basis whatsoever for this kind of stuff. And so it's not exactly the same thing, and you have no evidence of facts here which disprove their allegation, as far as I can tell.
Oh, no, but we do. And the evidence and it's undisputed, is that there were, and in every case there are, individual negotiations. Now, plaintiffs say, well, we don't rely on individual negotiations, all right? That's their theory. They say, that's not like it. But you can't blink reality and ignore what happened here. Their argument is that we did not adequately know about add-ons. All right, that's their argument. And again, their argument comes from an informed at the end of the process, after it's the contract. After you've agreed on a price, you go back and you create this form, this document. And their argument is that we did not have knowledge about these add-ons because they were not disclosed in this form. Fundamentally, that's their argument. And our argument is, but that so you have to prove a lack of knowledge. You can't prove it when there are these addendum stickers. It's on page 4 of our brief. Every car on the lot that's already been worked up is addendum stickers, and you have individualized negotiations. So maybe it's the fact that some member of the class, maybe Ms. Garcia, didn't know about these. I can see that, but maybe she didn't know about that. But they can't prove class-wide an absence of knowledge. It's, again, I guess, if you have a uniform omission, a lot of courts have said that's not subject to class certification because there are individual issues of reliance. Classic case, Second Circuit in McLaughlin, talked about uniform misrepresentations about the so-called health benefits of light cigarettes. And the trial court, Judge Weinstein in Brooklyn, found that that was a uniform omission and that you can infer reliance, that the reason people buy light cigarettes were because they wanted the health benefits or the less of a health risk than so-called full cigarettes or whatever the normal cigarettes are called. The Second Circuit said that you can't presume each individual consumer relied on that. Even though it's a uniform misrepresentation, you can't infer that. A fascinating case, Judge Weinstein later, in after getting reversed in that case, in the Cyprexa case that we cited, said, I still believe that you can do that, but I recognize, and he cited 8 Federal Courts of Appeals cases, that this individualized proof rule can preclude classing a case when there's individual issues of reliance, even if there's a uniform misrepresentation.
Mr. Conley, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt your organization here because I was struck by what you said about the second class being a headless class, Ms. Garcia not being appropriate as the head of that class. And I was just looking back at Jane Tidball's findings, and it seems to me that she says very specifically that Ms. Garcia is, in fact, a member of that class, despite your contention.
Well, there are two classes.
The second class is the one I'm talking about.
I think they're self-defeating classes. They
say, well, but her finding is that she is a member. Specifically, defendants said it's, however, Class 2 is defined as all consumers who receive dealer-added products under that definition. Garcia is a member of that class.
And if that's defined as clear as well, there are two.
So you're arguing that is a clearly erroneous finding as opposed to an abuse of discretion? There's no evidence in the record which would support that?
Yes, there are 100, the universe of people
that's a pretty high standard to say that there's no evidence at all which would suggest that is a clearly erroneous standard.
Let me take that on because
please, would you? Yeah.
There are 100%, there are 10,000 MedVet buyers in the two classes. She found that 4,000 are in Class 1. They are people that paid for products that they did not receive. Class 2 are people that paid for products and did receive them. So you got to be one or the other. And otherwise, we're finding more than 100% of the buyers.
Well, not necessarily, Mr. Conley. You might get some of the add-ons, but not others. And they were omitted in the buyer sale document.
That's the point. Class 1 are people that did not receive one or more add-ons.
Okay.
And Class 2 are people that got all the add-ons that they were promised.
But they weren't told about it.
Pardon?
But they weren't told about it. So basically, there's a lack of disclosure as to both classes. And I guess, how could, if things aren't disclosed by salesmen, how could possibly have you cured the problem for those non-disclosures?
Thank you, Ryan, because you picked up the verb they've used. We're not talking about curing a problem.
Well, I think you are. Face-to-face transactions, the individualized argument you're making is curing the problem of the class-wide liability issues.
The problem, as I understand the problem, is lack of disclosure.
That's right. We're trying
to prove disclosure. Right? We're trying to prove it. The problem is the lack of disclosure on a form. That's the allegedly uniform.
That's right.
We're trying to prove that even if there were, if there had to be disclosure in a form which you would dispute, and even if they didn't know from that form, there are other ways in which most, if not all, would have known of this. So we're not trying to cure a violation. We're trying to prove affirmative disclosures. This is not a uniform omission case because there are other ways in which the existence and cost of add-ons were disclosed to the class. They were disclosed on Windows. I mean, that's not, you know, whether or not individual knew about that or not. I think most would have known about that. If you look in their window, you would have known about that. But that's an individualized issue. To infer that nobody in the class knew about this, you're inferring a lack of knowledge by the entire, that nobody knew about the existence and price of add-ons. That's really what this plaintiff class is asking to be inferred on a class-wide basis. And again, Benzie did hold, and Your Honor knows it better than me, but very clearly held that you must have class-wide proof about each element. And he said there may be a uniform theory of omission in Benzie, but the question is, did that omission cause injury to each and every class member? And our simple point is that even if there's a uniform omission on this form, it cannot be inferred, much less presumed, that that omission caused injury because there are other ways in which consumers had the ability to, and most in fact did, acquire knowledge about the existence and cost of add-ons. Our point is simply that individualized negotiations based on window stickers, I'm not convincing that it's not a false negotiation, but I think that if you have a disclosure at a window of, we're asking $15,000 for this and $500 of add-ons, and the price is $15,500, and you end up paying $14,000 because you decided, I don't want any add-ons and I don't want to pay for them, there's no injury. And forcing us to undergo a class would be forcing us to have an inference or a presumption against us that these people, each and every one of them, were injured by something that most of them knew, and we could prove individually that most of them knew. If somebody came in and said, you know, this hypothetical buyer paid $14,000, I paid too much for these add-ons, I didn't know about them, we could say, well, didn't you have an addendum sticker? Didn't you have individualized discussions with your agent? One other thing in this addendum sticker, and I think it's an important point I'd want to mention, is that when you, at the end of a sale, when you buy your car, you get the buyer order form, which is the alleged violation for not disclosing the itemization of the different prices. You also get the two stickers. You get in your driveway package, you get an addendum sticker and you get an MSRP Monroney sticker. So to assume that there's no disclosure on a class-wide basis is something that I think is too big a stretch of
the I think what it's an issue here is what's supposed to be in that written document the legislature said had to be there. And it doesn't seem to me that the document is setting forth the elements, the factors that have to do with the transaction. So what's the reason for the legislature's and the recital? Let's assume the recital says, this document says everything about the transaction. Yeah. So I'm not getting it.
The legislature is subsection M of the CCPA,
right.
And that simply says an installment contract. And by the way, the classes are too broad because they cover not just installment buyers, but cash buyers. But in the installment contract, it says you have to have a, quote, description of the goods. It doesn't say anything about line item, and plaintiff's counsel said, you know, it requires a line item. I mean, that's doing a little more than simply a description of the goods. We would submit, in fact, that the real retail installment sales contract is not this buyer order form, but rather, and that's Exhibit 2 to the plaintiff's class certification motion, but rather Exhibit 4, which is a retail installment sales contract. And that's simply, we've all seen, and it's more the truth in lending form that says annual percentage rate, and by financing this $15,500, you're effectively paying $20,000, and you're, you know, and the interest is, you know, all the different interest calculations. The description of the goods in that form simply says 2006 Chevy Cobalt. That's the description of the goods. All right, so we think the district court focused on the wrong document in the first place. This buyer order form is not the retail installment sales contract. That buyer order form is a document that controls for cash sales and every other kind of sales. Now, when you have a consumer installment sale, then you have a separate truth in lending document. That's Exhibit 4 to the plaintiff's class certification motion. And that the description of goods there is even less than the description of goods here. It's simply, you know, Chevy Cobalt and then a VIN number. And we would submit, Justice Hobbs, that's an adequate description of the goods. Now, we're on the merits of this, of why we think that you know, this alleged uniform violation is not, in fact, a violation of the CCPA. But for the purpose of this case, we can assume that, you know, that we can assume that they have a uniform theory of a violation of the CCPA on this form, that uniformly violated the CCPA. If that's the case, then there are a lot of dealers that are going to be in trouble with their forms, because it's a standard rentals and rentals form. So on the bottom of it, you'll see it's a standard form. It's not a, you know, but anyway, assuming there's a uniform theory of breach, our central thrust is that there is not a uniform theory to prove that that breach, the omission on that form, caused injury to each and every one of the class members that had a variety, each deal is different, a variety of ways of coming to the final agreement on what they were going to pay in a given price. And to say that this person that that hypothetically said, I don't want your ads, I don't want to pay for them, and I want to pay below MSRP, he was a good negotiator, and that person is a member of the class, we submit that that's an inference and a presumption that's not warranted under the facts and circumstances of this case.
Will there ever be presumptive reliance in a deceptive trade practices action, in your view?
Absolutely.
And what would be the proper circumstances then?
I didn't take the Vasquez case where Justice Mosk in California Supreme Court has relied on 1971 uniform omissions about and misrepresentations about the benefits of a freezer and a prepackaged food thing that was marketed in a misleading way. Same omission. An easier case, right, would be the vanishing premium cases. They rely heavily on the Varicaro case out of New Jersey Appellate Division in 2000. Most courts have said vanishing premiums. It was a standard, you know, there was a lot of litigation around the country in these vanishing premium cases where there was a misleading prepackaged description, uniform, no variation. They said, a lot of courts say you can't presume reliance because what was important to one person might not be to another. But at least in that case, there was a uniform theory. Nobody deviated from that script. There's no script in a sale of the car. For that reason, we asked the court to affirm the Court of Appeals.
I believe that almost everything Mr. Connolly said confirms that predominance is not defeated here, confirms the predominance of common issues. He argued about the law. The law applies to all members of the class. He argued about inferences that can be drawn from common facts. Those apply across the board. In response to Justice Marquez's question, is there ever a case? And the answer was yes. Where things are sufficiently uniform, you have class-wide proof of causation. You have a common inference that supports predominance. Well, the next question is, who decides? And I think the answer to that is obvious. The trial court decides, because the trial court has an opportunity to review all the facts that were the bulk of Mr. Connolly's argument. The trial court decides if it's sufficiently uniform, then evaluate whether or not there's any abuse of discretion. Here there's not, and a class can be certified. I want to cut through a little bit of the factual back and forth, because I think respondents' argument is that because there might be some good negotiators who end up paying more or less for these add-ons and maybe nothing, that creates individual questions. This is a critical fact. They argued, respondents argued, that the way that they comply with the Colorado statute that says you have to disclose in writing, unambiguously, all the terms of the transaction, obviously the price is the most important term of the transaction, the way they argue that they complied with that statute is by telling consumers in the buyer's order that here are the line items we charged you for the add-ons. So this is not a case in which some people may be paid more and some people may be paid less. This is a case in which they have argued, as a way of arguing that they complied with their statutory duty, exactly what they charged each and every consumer. So they really don't have the flexibility to now come in here and say there are differences in every case.
I interrupt you. I'm struggling to understand what is the nature of the injury for the Class 2 plaintiffs. I understand very clearly I'm not going to pay for something I didn't get, but what is the nature of the injury in the Class 2 context? Is it simply, literally, the omission of the line item in the buyer order?
Could you also address the headless class argument?
Yes. There is a difference between the fact of injury and the amount of injury. Class 2, we know that they all purchased add-ons. They all purchased cars in which there was a charge for add-ons. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the class. So we know they purchased cars and that they paid for an add-on. Let's say $500. The damages question, so they all have the fact of injury. The damages question is how much more did they pay, not having adequate disclosures, than they would have paid if they had good disclosures? There are a variety of ways that we can prove that as a substantive matter. We could say, well, maybe it's the whole cost of the add-ons. Maybe it's the difference between what they paid and what a preferred customer, you know, who didn't have to negotiate, who didn't have to rely on those omissions, would have paid. But there are a lot of ways we could do that at the damages phase, and a lot of ways the trial court, in her discretion, could manage that issue. But what's absolutely clear is that the fact of damage exists for everyone in Class 2. The amount of damage will be different, and the ways that we can prove it are really for a later date.
Essentially, it's still an economic injury. In other words, the material omission led me to pay for this add-on more than I probably would have had I known about it.
Yes.
Okay.
The headless class. Ms. Garcia is a particularly strong person to represent both classes because she did not get adequate disclosures in an installment sale. She paid for things that weren't on her car. She paid for items that were not properly disclosed. She didn't even have the ability to say, hey, wait a minute, there's no pinstripe on my car, because she didn't know that the charges she was getting charged for included pinstripe. So class one, people who paid for things not on their car, she's obviously that. Class two, people who got inadequate disclosures and thereby paid more than they otherwise would have. In her case, she paid 100% more than she otherwise would have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case will stand submitted on briefs.